The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I will finish the story from last week, written by Nobel Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who contributed nearly a dozen pieces to the New Yorker between 1974 and 2003, and published more than 30 books, including 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Life of Time of Cholera. The story that I'll finish today was published in the September 27, 1976 edition of the New Yorker as an excerpt from his 1975 novel, The Autumn of the Patriarch, about an aging Caribbean dictator who grows increasingly paranoid in his isolation and more aggressive in his monstrous actions. If you haven't listened to the first part of this story, you can find it on the website, ncreadingservice.org, under the list of podcasts. Click on the New Yorker magazine, and then the file Yorker 071020. And now, from the September 27th, 1976 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the second part of The Autumn of the Patriarch by Gabriel Marquez. We left off with Patricio Aragonés, the general's look-alike and double, having been fatally wounded by a poisoned dart, and the general is sitting with him as he dies. He stayed with him during his slow agony, the two of them alone in the room, giving him the spoonfuls of anodyne with his own hand. And Patricio Aragonés took them without gratitude, telling him between spoonfuls, "I will leave you here for a while, my general, with your world of stink, because my heart tells me that quite soon we shall meet again in the depths of hell. I all twisted up worse than a mullet because of this poison, and you, with your head in your hand, looking for a place to put it. Let it be said without the least bit of respect, General Sir, that I can now tell you that I never loved you, as you think, but that ever since the days of the filibusters, when I had the evil misfortune to chance into your domains, I've been praying that you would be killed, in a good way even, so that you would pay me back for this life of an orphan you gave me. First by tamping my feet flat so that they would be those of a sleepwalker like yours. And then by piercing my nuts with a shoemaker's awl so I would develop a rupture. And then by making me drink turpentine so I would forget how to read and write after all the work it took my mother to teach me. And always obliging me to go through the public ceremonies you didn't dare face. And not because the nation needs you alive, as you say, but because even the toughest man can get all tight when he crowns a beauty whore and doesn't know from what direction death will explode in on him. Let it be said that without the least respect, General, but he wasn't bothered by the insolence, but rather by the ingratitude of Patricio Aragonés, who I set up in life like a king in a palace, and I gave you what no one has ever given anybody in this world, even lending you my own women. We'd best not talk about that, General, Patricio Aragonés said, because it's better to be gelded by a mace than to go about laying mothers on the ground as if it were a matter of branding calves, just because those poor heartless waifs don't even feel the brand or kick or twist or complain like calves, and they don't smoke from the haunches or smell of sin's flesh, which is the least one asks of a good woman. But they lay down their dead cow body so a person can do his duty while they go on peeling potatoes and shouting to the other women, 'Please keep an eye on the kitchen for me while I take a breather here so my rice doesn't burn.' Only you would think that stuff like that is love, General, because it's the only kind you know, without the least respect, of course." And then he began to roar, "Shut up, damn it, shut up or you'll pay for it." But Patricio Aragonés kept on saying, without the slightest intention of a joke, "Why should I shut up when all you can do is kill me, and you're already killing me? It'd be better now to take advantage and look truth in the face, General, so you can know that no one who has ever told you what he really thinks but that everyone tells you what he knows you want to hear while he bows to your face and thumbs his nose at you from behind. You might even thank fate that I'm the man who most pities you in this world, because I'm the only one who looks like you, the only one honorable enough to sing out to you what everyone says, that you're the president of nobody, and that you're not on the throne because of your big guns, but because the English set you there and the gringos kept you there with the pair of guns on their battleship. Because I saw you scurrying like a cockroach this way and that, back and forth, when the gringos shouted to you we're leaving you here with your whorehouse. So let's see if you can put it all together without us. And if you never got up from your chair since that time or have never gone out, it's probably not because you don't want to, but because you can't. Recognize it. Because you know that the moment they see you on the street dressed as a mortal, they're going to fall on you like a pack of dogs to collect from you. In one case, for the killings at Santa Maria del Altar. In another, for the prisoners thrown into the moat of the harbor fort to be eaten by crocodiles. In another, for the people you skin alive and whose hides you send to their families as a lesson, he said, dipping into the bottomless well of his long postponed rancor, and drawing out the string of atrocities of his regime of infamy, until he could no longer tell him any more because a fiery rake tore his guts apart. His heart softened again, and he ended with no instance of offense, but almost one of supplication. I'm serious, General. Take advantage of the fact that I'm dying now and die with me. No one has more right than I to tell you this, because I never had any intention of looking like anyone, much less a national hero, but only a sad little glassblower making bottles like my father. Take a chance, General. It doesn't hurt as much as it seems. And he said it with an air of such serene truth that the rage to answer did not overcome him, but rather he tried to hold Patricio Aragones up in his chair when he saw that he was starting to twist about and hold his belly in his hands and was sobbing with tears of pain and shame. I am so sorry, General, but I'm messing in my pants. And he thought he meant it in a figurative sense, that he was dying of fear, but Patricio Aragones answered him, no, I mean real essing, General, and he managed to beseech him, hold on, Patricio Aragones, hold on. We generals of the fatherland have to die like men, even if we pay for it with our lives. But he said it too late, because Patricio Aragones fell face down and on top of him, kicking with fear and soaked in filth and tears. In the office next to the hearing room, he had to scrub the body with dish rag and soap to get rid of the bad smell. He dressed it in the clothes he was wearing. He put the canvas truss on, the boots, the gold spur on the left heel, feeling as he did it that he was changing into the most solitary man on earth. And last of all, he erased all traces of the farce and prefigured the perfection down to the tiniest details that he had seen with his own eyes in the premonitory waters of the basins, so that at dawn on the next day, the cleaning women would find the body, as they did find it, stretched out face down on the floor of the office, dead for the first time of natural causes in his sleep, in his denim uniform with no insignia, his boots, the gold spur, and with his right arm folded under his head as a pillow. They did not spread the news immediately that time either, contrary to what he had expected, but many prudent hours passed with clandestine investigations, secret agreements among the heirs of the regime, who were trying to gain time by denying the rumor of death with all manner of contradictory versions. They brought his mother, Bendicion Alvarado, out into the commercial district to show that she was not wearing a mourning face. They dressed me in a flowered dress like a chippy, sir. They made me buy a macaw feather hat so that everybody would see me happy. They made me buy every piece of junk to be found in the stores in spite of my telling them, no, sir, it wasn't a time for buying but for crying. because even I believed that it was really my son who had died. And they forced me to smile when people took full-length pictures of me because the military man said it had to be done for the good of the country. Meanwhile, he wondered, confused in his hiding place, what's happening out in the world? Since nothing had changed with the trick of his death, how was it that the sun had risen and had risen again without stumbling? Why, that Sunday look, Mother, why the same hat, heat, without me? He was wondering in surprise when a sudden cannon shot sounded from the fortress on the harbor, and the main bells of the cathedral began to toll, and all the way up to Government House came the surge of the crowds that were rising up out of the age-old morass with the greatest piece of news in the world. And then he half opened the bedroom door and peeped into the audience room and saw himself laid out more dead and more decorated than all the dead popes of Christendom, wounded by the horror and the shame of his own body of a military stud lying among the flowers, his face with powder, pale with powder, his lips painted, the hard hands of a dauntless young lady crossed over the chest, armored with military decorations, the showy dress uniform with the 10 pips of the General of the Universe, a rank someone had invented for him after death, the King of Spades saber he had never used, the patent leather boots with 2 gold spurs, the vast paraphernalia of power and the lugubrious martial glories reduced to the human size of a faggot lying in state. "Damn it, that can't be me," he said to himself, contemplating the procession that was parading around his corpse, and for an instant he forgot the murky reasons for the farce and felt raped and diminished by the inclemency of death toward the majesty of power. He saw life without him. He saw with a certain compassion how men were bereft of his authority. He saw with a hidden uneasiness those who had only come to decipher the enigma of whether it really was or was not he. He was a very old man who gave them Masonic salute from the days of the Federalist War. He saw a man in mourning who kissed his ring. He saw a schoolgirl who laid a flower on him. He saw a fishwife who could not resist the truth of his death and strewed her basket of fresh fish all over the floor and embraced the perfumed corpse, sobbing aloud that it was him, my God. What's going to become of us without him? She wept. So it was him, they shouted. It was him, shouted the throng, suffocated by the sun in the main square. And then the bells of the cathedral stopped tolling their knell, and those of all the churches announced a Wednesday of jubilation. Easter rockets exploded, Roman candles, drums of liberation, and he watched the assault groups that came in through the window in the face of the silent complacency of the guard. He watched the ferocious leaders who dispersed the procession with clubs and knocked down the inconsolable fishwife. He watched the ones who attacked the corpse, the 8 men who took it out of its immemorial state and its chimerical time of agapanthus lilies and sunflowers and dragged it down the stairs, those who gutted the insides of that paradise of opulence and misfortune, thinking they were destroying the lair of power forever, knocking over the papier-mâché Doric capitals, velvet curtains, and Babylonian columns crowned with alabaster palm trees, throwing bird cages out the window, the throne of the viceroys, the grand piano, breaking the funeral urns with the ashes of unknown patriots and Gobelin tapestries of maidens asleep in gondolas of disillusion and enormous old paintings of bishops and archaic military men and inconceivable naval battles, annihilating that world so that in the memory of future generations, not the slightest memory of the cursed line of men of arms would remain. And then he peeped into the street through the slats in the blinds to see what degree the ravages of defenestration had reached. And with just one glance, he saw more infamy and more ingratitude than had ever been seen and wept over by his eyes since the day he was born. Mother, he saw his merry widows leaving the building through the service entrance. leading the cows from the stables by the halter, carrying off government furniture, the jars of honey from your hives, mother. He saw his 7-month runts making jubilation with kitchen pots and treasures from the crystal and table service for pontifical banquets, singing with street urchin shouts, "My papa is dead! Hooray for freedom!" He saw the bonfire that had been lighted in the main square to burn the official portraits, and the almanac lithographs that had been in all places and at all times ever since the beginning of his regime. And he saw his own body dragged by, as it left behind, along the street a trail of medals and epaulets, hussar's buttons, strands of brocade and frog braiding, and tassels from the playing card saber, and the 10 sad pips of General of the Universe. "Mother, look what they've done to me," he said, feeling in his own flesh the ignominy of the spitting and the sick bed pans that were thrown on him from the balconies as he went by, horrified by the idea of being quartered and devoured by dogs and vultures amidst the delirious howls and the roar of fireworks celebrating the carnival of his death. When the cataclysm had passed, he still heard the distant music of the windless afternoon. He went on killing mosquitoes, and with the same slaps trying to kill the katydids in his ears, which hindered him in his thinking. He still saw the light of the fires on the horizon, the lighthouse that tinted him with green every 30 seconds through the slits in the blinds, the natural breathing of daily life, which was getting to be the same again, while his death was changing into a different death, more like so many others in the past, the incessant torrent of reality which was carrying him toward the no man's land of compassion and oblivion. "Damn it! Screw death!" he exclaimed, and then he left his hiding place exalted by the certainty that his grandest hour had struck. He went through the sacked salons, dragging his thick phantom feet in the midst of the ruins of his former life. In the shadows that smelled of dying flowers and burial candle wicks, he pushed open the door of the cabinet room. He heard through the smoky air the thin voices around the long walnut table, and saw the smoke that all the ones he wanted to be there were there. The liberals who had sold the Federalist War, the conservatives who had bought it, the generals of the high command, 3 of his cabinet ministers, the archbishop and ambassador Schottner, all together in one single plot calling for the unity of all against the despotism of centuries, so that they could divide up among themselves the booty of his death. So absorbed in the depths of greed that no one noticed the appearance of the unburied president, who gave a single blow with the palm of his hand on the table and shouted, "Aha!" And that was all he had to do. For when he lifted his hand from the table, the stampede of panic was over, and all that was left in the room were the overflowing ashtrays, the coffee mugs, the chairs flung on the floor, and his comrade of a lifetime, General Rodrigo de Aguilar, in battle dress, minute, impassive, wafting from the smoke with his one hand and indicating to him to drop to the floor. "General, sir, because now the fun is going to begin." And they both dropped to the floor at the instant the machine gun's death jubilation started up by the front of the building. The butcher feast of the Presidential Guard, who with great pleasure and great honor, General, sir, carried out his fierce orders that no one should escape alive from the meeting where treason was being hatched. Any who tried to escape through the main door were mowed down with the machine gun bursts. The ones who were hanging out the windows were shot down like birds from a blind. The ones who were able to escape the encirclement and took refuge in nearby houses were gutted out with phosphorus grenades. And they finished off the wounded in accordance with the presidential criterion that any survivor is a dangerous enemy as long as he lives. While he remained lying face down on the floor 2 feet away from General Rodrigo de Aguilar, tolerating the hail of glass and plaster that came through the windows with every explosion, murmuring without pause as if he were praying, That's it, old friend, that's it. The trouble's over. From now on, I'm going to rule alone with no dogs to bark at me. Tomorrow, we'll have to see what good has come out of this damned mess and what hasn't. And if we don't have anything to sit on in the meantime, we'll get 6 leather stools of the cheapest sort, some straw mats, and put them here and there to cover up the holes. We'll buy a few more odds and ends, and that's it. No plates, no spoons, no nothing. I'll bring it all from the barracks, because I'm not going to have any military men or officers around, damn it. All they're good for is to waste more milk, and when there's trouble, as we've seen, they spit on the hand that feeds them. I'll only keep the Presidential Guard, who are straight shooters and brave fellows. And I'm not going to name any cabinet, damn it. Just a good Minister of Health, for health is the only thing anyone really needs in life. And maybe another one with a good hand for what has to be put in writing. And that way we can rent out the ministries and barracks and save money on help. Because what's needed here isn't people, but money. We'll get 2 good maids, one for cleaning and cooking, and the other to wash and iron. I'll take care of the cows and the birds myself when we get some, and no more of chumping whores in the toilets or lepers in the rose bushes or doctors of philosophy who know everything or wise politicians who see everything, because, after all, this is a presidential palace and not a whorehouse, as Patricio Argonis said, the gringo said. And I'm more than enough to keep on ruling all alone until the comet comes by again. And not just once, but 10 times. Because the way I am, I don't intend to die again, damn it. Let other people die, he said, talking without any pauses to think, as if he were reciting by heart, because he had known ever since the war that thinking aloud was driving off the fear of the dynamite charges that were shaking the building. Making plans for tomorrow in the morning and for the coming century at dusk, until the last coup de grace rang out in the street and General Rodrigo de Aguilar crawled over to the window and gave the order to get the garbage wagons and take away the dead bodies. And he left the room saying, "Have a good night, General." "The same to you, old friend," he answered. "Thank you very much," lying face down on the funereal marble of the cabinet room. And then he folded his right arm to serve as a pillow and fell asleep at once, more alone than ever, lulled by the sound of the trail of yellow leaves of his autumn of pain, which had begun forever that night with the smoking bodies and the puddles of red moons of the massacre. He did not have to take any of the predicted measures because the army broke up upon its own. The troops scattered. The few officers who resisted until the last moment in the garrisons in the city and in another 6 in the countryside were wiped out by the Presidential Guard with the help of civilian volunteers. The surviving ministers fled into exile at dawn, and only the 2 most faithful remained, one who was also his private physician, and the other had the best handwriting in the country. And he did not have to kowtow to any foreign power, because the government coffers were overflowing with wedding rings given as surety by instant partisans. Nor did he have to buy any mats or leather stools of the cheapest sort to repair the ravages of defenestration, because even before the pacification of the country was over, the audience room was restored and more sumptuous than ever. And there were bird cages everywhere, chattering macaws, royal lorry parrots who sang in the cornices for Spain and not for Portugal. Discreet and serviceable women who kept the building as neat and clean as a battleship. And in through the windows came the music of glory, the same Roman candles of excitement, the same bells of jubilation that had begun celebrating his death and went on celebrating his immortality. And there was a great permanent rally in the main square, with shouts of eternal support and large signs saying, "God save the magnificent who rose from the dead on the third day." An endless celebration that he did not have to prolong with any secret maneuvers as he had done at other times, because affairs of state took care of themselves without any help. The nation went along. He alone was the government. and no one circumvented his will, whether by word or deed, because he was so alone in his glory that he no longer had any enemies left. And he was so thankful for his comrade of a lifetime, Arrigo de Aguilar, that he did not get nervous again over the expense of the milk, but ordered the private soldiers who had distinguished themselves by their ferocity and sense of duty to form in the courtyard. And pointing to them according to the impulses of his inspiration, he promoted them to the highest ranks, knowing that he was restoring the armed forces who were going to spit on the hand that fed them. You to captain, you to major, you to colonel, what I am saying to general, and all the rest to lieutenant. What the hell, old friend, here's your army. And he was so moved by those who had been grieved by his death, that he had them fetch the old man with the Masonic salute and the gentleman in mourning who had kissed his ring, and he decorated them with the Medal of Peace. He had them bring in the fishwife, and he gave her what she said she needed most, which was a house with a lot of rooms where she could live with her 14 children. He had had them bring in the schoolgirl who laid a flower on the corpse and granted her what she most wanted in this world, which was to get married to a man of the sea. But in spite of those acts of relief, his confused heart did not have a moment of rest until in the courtyard of the San Geronimo barracks he saw, bound and spat upon, the assault groups who had sacked the presidential palace. He recognized them one by one with a remorseless memory of rancor, and he went about separating them into different groups according to the intensity of the offense. You here, the one who led the assault, you over there, the ones who had thrown the inconsolable fishwife to the floor, you here, the ones who had taken the corpse out of the coffin and dragged it down the stairs and through the mire, and all the rest on this side. Although he was really not interested in the punishment, but in proving to himself that the profanation of the body and the attack on the building had not been a spontaneous and popular act, but an infamous mercenary deal. So he took charge of the interrogation of the prisoners, physically present and doing the talking himself, to get them to tell him willingly the illusory truth that his heart needed. But he could not manage it. He had been hung from a horizontal beam like parrots. He had them hung from a horizontal beam like parrots, tied hand and foot with their heads down, for hours on end. But he could not manage it. He had one thrown into the moat of the courtyard, and the others saw him quartered and devoured by the crocodiles. But he could not manage it. He chose one of the main group and had him skinned alive in the presence of all, and they saw his flesh tender and yellow like a newborn placenta, and they felt the soaking of the warm blood broth of the body that had been laid bare as it went through its throes, thrashing about on the courtyard stones. And then they confessed what he wanted, that they had been paid 400 gold pesos to drag the corpse to the dung heap in the marketplace, that they didn't want to do it for love or money because they had nothing against him, all the less so since he was dead, but that at a secret meeting where they even saw two generals from the high command, they had all been frightened with every manner of threat, and that was why we did it, General, sir. Word of honor. And then he exhaled a great mouthful of relief, ordered that they be fed and allowed to rest that night, and in the morning thrown to the crocodiles. Poor deceived boys, he sighed, and went back to the presidential palace with his heart free of the hair shirt of doubt, murmuring, you all saw it, damn it, you all saw it, these people love me. Resolved to dissipate even the dregs of the uneasiness that Patricio Aragonés had sown in his heart, he decided that those acts of torture would be the last of his regime. The crocodiles were killed, the torture chambers, where it was possible to crumble every bone in the body one by one without killing, were dismantled. He proclaimed a great amnesty. He looked to the future with a magical idea that came to him. The trouble with this country is that the people have too much time in their hands to think. And looking for a way to keep them busy, he restored the March Poetry Festival and the annual contest for the election of a beauty queen. He built the largest baseball stadium in the Caribbean and imparted to our team the motto of victory or death. And he ordered a free school established in each province to teach sweeping, and the pupils fantasized by the presidential stimulus went on to sweep the streets after having swept their houses and then the nearby highways and roads, so that in official processions with the national flag and large banners saying, "God save the all-pure who watches over the cleanliness of the nation," piles of trash were carried back and forth from one province to another without anyone's knowing what to do with them. While he dragged his slow feet of a meditative beast about in search of new formulas to keep the civilian population busy, opening a way among the lepers and blind men and cripples who begged the salt of health from his hands, baptizing with his name at the font in the courtyard the children of his godchildren among persistent adulators who proclaimed him the one and only, because now he could not count on the resources of any look-alike, and he had to make himself double in a marketplace of a palace where every day cages and more cages of rare birds arrived, ever since the secret was left out that his mother, Bendición Alvarado, followed the trade of bird woman. And even though some sent them out of adulation and others sent them as a joke, after a short time there was no room to hang any more cages. And he tried to attend to so many public matters at the same time that among the crowds and the courtyards and the offices it was impossible to tell who were the servants and who were the ones being served. And they knocked down so many walls to make more room and opened so many windows for a view of the sea that the simple act of going from one room to another was like crossing the deck of a sailboat adrift in a crosswind autumn. The March trade winds had always come in through the windows of the building, but now they said they were the winds of peace, General Sir. And it was the same buzzing in the eardrums that he had heard for many years. But even his physician told him that it was the buzz of peace, General Sir. Because ever since they had found him dead, the first time of all things in heaven and on earth had changed into the things of peace, General Sir. And he believed it. And he believed it so much that in December he went back to going up to the house on the reef to seek solace in the misfortune of the brotherhood of nostalgic former dictators. And the second time he was found chewed away by vultures in the same office, wearing the same clothes and in the same position, none of us were old enough to remember what had happened the first time. But not even the least prudent among us would accept appearances, because so many times it had been a given fact that he was prostrate with epilepsy and would fall off his throne during the course of audiences, twisting with convulsions as gall froth foamed out of his mouth, that he had lost his speech from so much talking and had ventriloquists stationed behind the curtains to make it appear that he was speaking, that shad scales were breaking out all over his body as punishment for his perversions, that in the coolness of December the rupture sang sea chanties to him, and he could only walk with the aid of a small orthopedic cart, which bore his herniated testicle, that a military van had brought in a coffin with gold trim and purple ribbons, and that someone had seen Bendición Alvarado bleeding to death from weeping in the rain garden. But the more certain the rumors of his death seemed, the more he would appear alive and authoritarian at the least expected moment to impose other unforeseen directions to our destiny. And we knew that no evidence of his death was final, because there was always another truth behind the truth. And now, from the personal history section of the June 22nd, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Trayvon Generation, for Solo, Simon, Robel, Maurice, Cameron, and Siku, by by Elizabeth Alexander. This one was shot in his grandmother's yard. This one was carrying a bag of Skittles. This one was playing with a toy gun in front of a gazebo. Black girl in bright bikini. Black boy holding cell phone. This one danced like a marionette as he was shot down in a Chicago intersection. The words, the names, Trayvon, Laquan, bikini, gazebo, Lucy's, Skittles, 2 seconds, I can't breathe, traffic stop, dashboard cam, 16 times. His dead body lay in the street in the August heat for 4 hours. He was jogging, was hunted down, cornered by a pickup truck and shot 3 times. One of the men who murdered him leaned over his dead body and was heard to say, effing N-word, I can't breathe, again. 8 minutes and 46 seconds of a knee and full weight on his neck. I can't breathe. And then, Mama, George Floyd cried. George Floyd cried, Mama, I'm through. His mother had been dead for 2 years when George Floyd called out for her as he was being lynched. Lynching is defined as a killing committed by a mob. I called the 4 police officers who arrested him a mob. The kids got shot and the grown-ups got shot. Which is to say, the kids watched their peers shot down and their parents' generation get gunned down and beat down and terrorized as well. The agglomerating spectacle continues. Here are a few we know less well. Danny Ray Thomas, Johnny Jermaine Rush, Nania Kane, DeJuan Hall, Atatiana Jefferson, Demetrius Brian Hollins, Jacqueline Craig and her children, and then the iconic Alton Sterling, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Walter Scott, Breonna Taylor, Philando Castile. Sandra Bland filmed the prelude to her death. The policeman thrust a stun gun in her face and said, I will light you up. I call the young people who grew up in the past 25 years the Trayvon generation. They always knew these stories. These stories formed their worldview. These stories helped instruct young African Americans about their embodiment and their vulnerability. The stories were primers in fear and futility. The stories were the ground soil of their rage. These stories instructed them that anti-black hatred and violence were never far. They watched these violations up close and on their cell phones so many times over. They watched them in near real time. They watched them crisscrossed and concentrated. They watched them on the school bus. They watched them under the covers at night. They watched them often outside of the presence of adults who loved them and were charged with keeping them safe in body and soul. This is the generation of my sons, now 22 and 20 years old, and their friends who are also children to me, and the university students I have taught and mentored and loved. And this is also the generation of Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old Minneapolis girl who came upon George Floyd's murder in progress while on an everyday run to the corner store on May 25th, filmed it on her phone, and posted it to her Facebook page at 1:46 a.m. with the caption, quote, they killed him right in front of a Cup Foods over south on 38th in Chicago. No type of sympathy. At police brutality, end quote. When InsideMPD.com, in an article that is no longer up, wrote, man dies after medical incident during police interaction, Frazier posted at 3:10 a.m., medical incident, ? Watch out, they killed him and the proof is clearly there, ! Darnella Frazier, 17 years old, witnessing a murder in close proximity, making a record that would have worldwide impact, returned the following day to the scene of the crime. She possessed the language to say precisely through tears, it's so traumatizing. In Toni Morrison's Sula, which is set across the bleak stretch of Ohio after the First World War, the character Hannah plaintively asked her mother, Eva Peace, Mama, did you ever love us? To paraphrase Eva Peace's reply, Love you. Love you. I kept you alive. I believed I could keep my sons alive by loving them. Believed in the magical powers of complete adoration and a love ethic that would permeate their lives. My love was armor when they were small. My love was armor when their father died of a heart attack when they were 12 and 13. They think black men only die when they get shot, my older son said in the aftermath. My love was armor when that same year our community's block watch sent emails warning residents about two black kids on bikes and praising neighbors who had called the police on them. My love for my children said, move. My love said, follow your sons, when they ran into the dark streets of New York to join protesters after Eric Garner's killer was acquitted. When my sons were in high school and pictures of Philando Castile were on the front page of the Times, I wanted to burn all the newspapers so they would not see the gun coming in the window, the blood on Castile's T-shirt, the terror in his partner's face, and the eyes of his witnessing baby girl. But I was too late. Too late generationally, because they were not looking at the newspaper. They were looking at their phones, where the image was a house of mirrors straight to hell. My love was both rational and fantastical. Can I protect my sons from being demonized? Can I keep them from moving free? But they must be able to move as free as the wind. If I listen to their fears, will I comfort them? If I share my fears, will I frighten them? Will racism and fear disable them? If we ignore it all, will it go away? Will dealing with race fill their minds like stones and block them from thinking of a million other things? Let's be clear about what motherhood is. A being comes into this earth and you are charged with keeping it alive. It dies if you do not tend it. It's as simple as that. No matter how intellectual and multicolored motherhood becomes as children grow older, the part that says, my purpose on earth is to keep you alive, has never totally dissipated. Magical thinking on all sides. I want my children, all of them, to thrive, to be fully alive. How do we measure what that means? What does it mean for our young people to be black, alive, and looking back at you, as June Jordan puts in her poem, Who Look at Me? How to access the sources of strength that transcend this American nightmare of racism and racist violence? What does it mean to be a lucky mother when so many of my sisters have had their children taken from them by this hatred? The painter Titus Kaphar's recent Time magazine cover portrays a black mother cradling what should be her child across the middle of her body. But the child is literally cut out of the canvas and cut out of the mother, leaving a gaping wound for an unending grief that has made a sisterhood of countless black women for generations. My sons were both a little shy outside of our home when they were growing up. They were quiet and observant, like their father, who had come to this country as a refugee from Eritrea. African observant, immigrant observant, missing nothing. I watched them over the years with their friends, doing dances now outmoded with names I persist in loving, Nay Nay, Hit Dem Folks, and talking about things I didn't teach them, and reading books I haven't read, and taking positions I don't necessarily hold, and I marvel. They are grown young men. With their friends, they talk about the pressure to succeed, to have a strong public face, to excel. They talk their big talk, they talk their hilarity, and they talk their fear. When I am with them, I truly believe the kids are all right and will save us. But I worry about this generation of young black people in depression. I have a keen eye, what Gwendolyn Brooks called gobbling mother's eye. For these young people, sons and friends and students whom I love and encourage and welcome into my home, keep in touch with and check in on. How are you? How are you? How are you? How are you, baby? How are you? I'm interested in the vision of television shows like Atlanta and Insecure, about which I've been asking every young person who will listen. Don't you think they're about low-grade undiagnosed depression and not black hipster innuendo? Why, in fact, did Earn drop out of Princeton?
Why does Van get high before a drug test? Why does Issa keep blowing up her life? This season, Insecure deals directly with the question of how young black people and mental health issues. Molly is in and out of therapy, and we learn that Nathan, also known as Lift Bay, who was ghosting Issa, has been dealing with bipolar disorder. The work of the creative icon of their generation often brings me to the question, why is Kendrick so sad? He has been frank about his depression and suicidal thoughts. It isn't just the specter of race-based violence and death that hangs over these young people. It's that compounded with the constant display of inequity that has most recently been laid bare in the COVID-19 pandemic, with racial health disparities that are shocking even to those of us inured to disproportionate suffering. Black creativity emerges from long lines of innovative responses to the death and violence that plague our communities. Not a house in the country ain't packed to its rafters with some dead Negro's grief, Toni Morrison wrote in Beloved. And I'm interested in creative emergencies from that ineluctable fact. There are so many visual artists responding to this changing same. Henry Taylor, Michael Rakowitz, Zatovia Gary, Carrie Mae Weems, Lauren Woods, Alexandria Bell, Black Women Artists for Black Lives Matter, Stephanie Jemison, Carrie James Marshall, Titus Kapar. To pause at one work, Dred Scott's A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, which he made in the wake of the police shooting of Walter Scott in 2015, echoes the flag, reading, quote, "A man was lynched yesterday," end quote, that the NAACP flew outside its New York headquarters between 1920 and 1938 to mark the lynchings of black people in the United States. I want to turn to three films that address the Trayvon generation with particular power: Flying Lotuses, Until the Quiet Comes, 2012. His Never Catch Me with Kendrick Lamar, 2014. And Lamar's All Right in 2015. In Until the Quiet Comes, the director, Cahill Joseph, moves us through black Los Angeles, Watts to be specific. In the fiction of the video, a boy stands in an empty swimming pool, pointing his finger as a gun and shooting. The bullet ricochets off the wall of the pool, and he drops as it appears to hit him. The boy lies in a wide arced swath of his blood, a portrait in the empty pool. He is another black boy down, another body of the traumatized community. In an eerie twilight, we move into the densely populated Nickerson Gardens, where a young man, played by the dancer Storyboard P, lies dead. Then he rises again and begins a startling dance of resurrection, perhaps coming back to life. The community seems numb, oblivious of his rebirth. That rebirth is brief. He gets into a lowrider car, that L.A. icon. The car drives off after his final death dance, taking him from this life to the other side. His death is consecrated by his performance, a ritual that the sudden dead are not afforded. The car becomes a hearse, a space of ritual transport into the next life. But the young man is still gone. What does it mean to be able to bring together the naturalistic and the visionary, to imagine community as capable of reanimating even its most hopeless and anesthetized members? What does it mean for a presumably murdered black body to come to life in his community in a dance idiom that is uniquely part of black culture and youth culture, all of that power channeled into a lifting? A sibling to Joseph's work is Hero Murai's video for Flying Lotus's Never Catch Me. It opens at a funeral for two children, a black boy and a girl, who lie heartbreak beautiful in their open caskets. Their community grieves inconsolably in the church. The scene is one of profound mourning. And then the children open their eyes and climb out of their caskets.
They dance explosively in front of the pulpit before running down the aisle and out of the church. The mourners cannot see this resurrection, for it is a fantasia. The kids dance another dance of black L.A., the force of black bodily creativity, that expressive life source born of violence and violation that have upturned the world for generations. The resurrected babies dance with a pumping force. But the community's grief is unmitigated because, once again, this is a dreamscape. The children spring out into the light and climb into a car. No, it's a hearse. And smiling with the joy of mischievous escapees, drive away. Kids are not allowed to drive. Kids are not allowed to die. What does it mean for a black boy to fly? To dream of flying and transcending? To imagine his invincible body all-powerful, a body that in this society is so often consumed as a moneymaker and an object of perverse desire, perceived to have superhuman and thus threatening powers? In the video for Kendrick Lamar's All Right, directed by Colin Tilley, Lamar flies through the California city streets, above sidewalks and empty lots, alongside wire fences. All Right has been the anthem of many protests against racism and police violence and unjust treatment. Lamar embodies the energy and the message of the resonant phrase, Black Lives Matter, which Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tometi catapulted into circulation when, in 2013, they founded the movement. The phrase was apt then and now. Its coinage feels both ancestral in its knowledge and prophetic in its ongoing necessity. I know now with certainty that there will never be a moment when we will not need to say it, not in my lifetime, and not in the lifetime of the Trayvon generation. The young black man flying in Lamar's video is joyful and defiant, rising above the streets that might claim him, his body liberated and autonomous. At the end of the video, a police officer raises a finger to the young man in the sky and mimes pulling the trigger. The wounded young man falls, slowly, another brother down, and lands. The gun was a finger. The flying young man appears safe. He does not get up. But in the final image of this dream, he opens his eyes and smiles. For a moment, he has not been killed. Black celebration is a village practice that has brought us together in protest and ecstasy around the globe and across time. Community is a mighty life force for self-care and survival, but it does not protect against murder. Dance itself will not free us. We continue to struggle against hatred and violence. I believe that this generation is more vulnerable and more traumatized than the last. I think of Frederick Douglass's words upon hearing slaves singing their sorrow songs in the fields. He laid waste to the nascent myth of the happy darkey. Quote, slaves sing most when they are most unhappy, end quote. Our dancing is our pleasure, but perhaps it is also our sorrow song. My sons love to dance. I've raised them to young adulthood. They are beautiful. They are funny. They are strong. They are fascinating. They are kind. They are joyful in friendship and community. They are righteous and smart in their politics. They are learning. They are loving. They are mighty and alive. I recall many sweaty summer parties with family friends where the grown-ups regularly acted up on the dance floor and the kids DJ'd to see how quickly they could make their old school parents and play uncles and aunties holler, "Hey, that's my jam!" They watched us with deep amusement, but they would dance too. One of the aunties glimpsed my sons around the corner in the next room and said, "Oh, my God, they can dance. They've been holding out on us, acting all shy." When I told a sister friend that my older son, during his freshman year in college,
was often the one controlling the aux cord, dancing and dancing and dancing. She said, "Remember, people dance when they are joyful." Yes, I am saying I measure my success as a mother of black boys in part by the fact that I have sons who love to dance, who dance in community, who dance till their powerful bodies sweat, who dance and laugh, who dance and shout, who are able, in the midst of their studying and organizing, their fear, their rage, their protesting, their vulnerability, their missteps and triumphs, their knowledge that they must fight the hydra-headed monster of racism and racial violence that we were not able to cauterize, to find the joy and the power of communal self-expression. This essay is not a celebration, nor is it an elegy. We are no longer enslaved. Langston Hughes wrote that we must stand atop the racial mountain, quote, free within ourselves, end quote. And I pray that those words have meaning for our young people. But our freedom must be seized and reasserted every day. People dance to say, "I am alive and in my body. I am black, alive, and looking back at you." We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138 or send me an email to info@ncratingservice.org. Let me know what you think of the broadcast, what you'd like to hear and what you don't want to hear. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.